The Reformation revealed the difference between the Roman Catholic view of salvation and that of the Reformers. But that was then, this is now. Do we still need to be concerned with the difference?
The two positions are simply incompatible. And you're going to have to choose at some point. Somebody's right and somebody's wrong. And who's ever wrong has significantly distorted the New Testament gospel.
There are those who say the divide between the Catholic Church and Protestants no longer exists. But as you just heard, Dr. R.C. Sproul maintains the differences have not been resolved. And he's going to address those differences today here on Renewing Your Mind. This lesson is from Dr. Sproul's series, Luther and the Reformation. Let's join him now.
We continue now with our study of Luther and the Reformation. In our last session, we looked initially at some of the steps involved in the Roman Catholic understanding of justification, and in this session, we want to look further at some of the elements involved in that particular view of justification. And in the following lectures, we'll try to see the contrast of the Reformation view of justification vis-a-vis the Roman view. In the 16th century, when this theological issue exploded, Roman Catholic Church gave a response in the middle of the 16th century with the calling of a major ecumenical council at the city of Trento in Italy, and it is called simply the Council of Trent. And reflections of that council are often discussed by the term Tridentine, which sounds like it would be pronounced Tridentine, but the normal pronunciation is Tridentine. And so when we look to the conciliar statements of the Council of Trent, we get an examination of the official formal decrees of the Roman Catholic Communion with respect to their doctrine of justification. And before I look at the content of that, just one word. Many people today believe that the Reformation is over and that the decrees of the Council of Trent are not relevant to ecumenical discussions today between Rome and Protestant representatives. And I always have to make the painful reminder to people that the Council of Trent is an ecumenical council carrying all the weight of the infallibility of the church behind it. And Rome suffers from a kind of theological hemophilia that if you scratch her theologically, she bleeds to death. So there's a certain sense in which Rome, in order to maintain her triumphant view of the authority of the church and of tradition, cannot repeal the canons and decrees of the Council of Trent. And as recently as the Catholic Catechism at the end of the 20th century, we saw a very clear reaffirmation of the authority of the Council of Trent. And so those who argue that the Tridentine teaching on justification is no longer relevant to the situation simply are ignoring what the church itself teaches. And when I speak about the church, I'm talking about the Roman community. You'll find priests in America and in the Western areas like Holland and Germany who dispute some of the Orthodox teachings of their own communion. But as far as the Roman Curia is concerned and the authorities in that city, the Council of Trent stands immutable as the teaching on justification. The Council of Trent was held over several sessions, and different issues were addressed at different sessions. The issue of the sacraments in one session, the issue of Scripture, for example, in the fourth session. Also, the problems of the corruption of the clergy and true reforms were brought to the church to try to clean up some of the problems of simony that we've mentioned before and other moral problems that had infected the church. But it is the sixth session of the Council of Trent that has the most relevance to the discussion of the doctrine of justification. And that session is divided into two parts. There is the formal teaching of the Roman Catholic view of justification as one section, and then following that are the canons that are set forth. And these canons have to do with the church's repudiation of error and of heresy. And in the 20-some canons of the Council of Trent, the formula begins in the same way. If anyone says that dot, 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 then the conclusion is, let him be anathema. The first three canons are directed against Pelagianism that had been condemned in earlier church councils and were not particularly aimed at the Protestant Reformation. Now, a careful examination of the canons of Trent reveal, I think, that in many cases where Rome aimed her guns at the reformers, they missed the reformers altogether. There were certain misunderstandings implied in their anathemas. And so some have looked at that and say, well, this whole thing was a misunderstanding, and the two sides were talking past each other and didn't really understand the issues. Unfortunately, that may be true to a degree, but not all the way. There's some of those canons that are right on the mark, and they do clearly anathematize the Reformation doctrine of justification by faith. Now, here's the significance of that. If the Reformation articulation of the biblical doctrine of justification is correct, and I, of course, believe it is, to anathematize it is to anathematize the gospel. And any communion or organization that claims to be Christian, if it denies or condemns an essential truth of Christianity, at that point, that organization becomes apostate and is no longer a true or valid church. And that's part of the problem with the ongoing discussions between Rome and Protestant bodies. There are many Protestant bodies really don't care about doctrinal differences, and they're happy to enter into ecumenical agreements with Rome. But if one takes the biblical doctrines of justification seriously, on that point, there can be no rapprochement. There can not be any unity unless one or the other sides surrenders, because the two positions are simply incompatible. And you're going to have to choose at some point which one is right. If somebody's right and somebody's wrong, and who's ever wrong has significantly distorted the New Testament gospel. And as the Apostle Paul said to the Galatians, if anyone teaches any other gospel than that which you have received, for there is no other gospel, he goes on to say, even if it's an angel from heaven, let him be anathema. So somebody is under the anathema of God here, and that issue, I'm quick to tell you, has not been resolved. Well, as serious as the canons of the anathemas of the Sixth Session of Trent are, I think the more difficult element to resolve the two sides is found in the first section of Session 6, when the doctrine of Rome is itself defined. Now, Rome goes to great lengths to define what saving faith is and what saving faith involves. And as I said before, it's a slanderous caricature to say that we believe in justification by faith and Rome simply believes in justification by works, as if faith were not necessary. Rather, Rome clearly teaches in the sixth session that faith is what we call a necessary condition for justification. And faith has three elements or steps in which it is involved. Rome, in the sixth session, speaks of faith as, quote, the initium, the fundamentum, and the radix of justification. To translate that, it means that faith is the initiation of justification. It's the starting place. that which begins the process of justification. It is the fundamentum, the foundation, the fundamental structure upon which justification is established. And without that foundation, without that fundamental structure, there can be no justification. And not only is it the initiation and the foundation, but it's also the rodex, or the root, the radical core of justification. Now, do you hear what that's saying? Is that for Rome, faith is no mere appendage to justification. It's not some insignificant plus that is added to the sacramental power of the church. Rather, faith, as I just said, initiates, is the foundation of, and is the radical core for justification. And so it is a necessary condition. That means it's a condition without which justification cannot follow. The difference, however, is that according to Rome, faith is not a sufficient condition. A sufficient condition refers to a condition that, if it is met, will surely issue in the desired result. Oxygen, by example, is in most cases a necessary condition for fire. But it's not a sufficient condition. No oxygen, no fire. But you can have oxygen all over the place and still not have fire, because it hasn't sufficient power to cause a fire. Thank goodness. Or every time we were in the presence of oxygen, we would be breathing flames. So you understand the difference between a necessary condition and a sufficient condition. Now, we know that the Council of Trent teaches that faith is not sufficient in and of itself to yield the result of justification, because in its treatment of the loss of justification through mortal sin, it explicitly declares that a person can have his faith intact, real faith intact, and while in a state of faith, commit mortal sin. And when you commit mortal sin while being in a posture of true faith, faith is not lost, but justification is. So you clearly see in that instance that one can have what we would call saving faith without justification. You can retain the faith but lose the justification because you have committed mortal sin. The next point we have to look at is how Rome understands what is the instrumental cause of justification. Now, when we speak of things that cause other things, we generally just think of causality in simple, one-dimensional terms. But the Roman Catholic Church distinguishes among several different types of causes. And in this case, this goes back to the medieval synthesis between Roman Catholic theology and the philosophy of the ancient Greek Aristotle. In Aristotle, contemplating the mystery of motion, what moves one thing to cause another, to produce change and mutations, he examined what he called various types of causes. And this becomes important to the discussion for this reason. Aristotle's famous illustration had to do with the making of a statue by a sculptor. And he distinguished among various causes. For example, the material cause, Aristotle defined, as that out of which something is made. You can't have a sculpture of stone without stone. And so the matter or the stuff out of which that beautiful sculpture is formed is the stone or the bronze or whatever material you're using would be the material cause. And then he talks about the formal cause. The formal cause would be if the artist would write a sketch at the beginning of what he wanted the final statue to look like, that would be his blueprint. That would be the format that he was following. And so that would be the formal cause. The final cause would be the purpose for which the statue was being made. Maybe it was being made to beautify somebody's garden, and that's why the sculptor was hired to make the sculpture. And you went on with the efficient cause. The efficient cause, that which actually brings about the effect of transforming the matter into a beautiful statue, would be the work of the sculptor himself. He's the efficient cause, and so on. Well, in that process, Aristotle spoke about the instrumental cause, the instrument or the tools that were used to bring about the change. A sculptor doesn't approach that block of granite or of marble with a picture of what he wanted to see at the end, a David or a Pietà or whatever, and then just simply spoke to the marble and said, be a statue. That wouldn't work too often. Usually the sculptor had to go to the task of taking his chisel, taking his hammer, and begin to chip away at that block of stone in order to shape it into a piece of art, so that the utensils that he used or the instruments that he used were called the instrumental cause of bringing the statue into existence. Now, in theological terms, Rome used that kind of metaphor and said that the instrumental cause of justification, the means, the tool that the church uses to bring a person into a state of justified grace, is the sacrament of baptism. And that's where the reformers, and we'll look at that more deeply next week, said, no, the sole instrumental cause is faith. Not the sacrament, but the faith that is in the heart of the believer. That's the instrument by which we are linked to the work of Christ for our salvation. So the question of what was the instrumental cause of justification was no small issue at the time. Also, I'd like to point out that in the Roman Catholic view, we call the Roman Catholic view of justification an analytical view. Question of an analytical view is this. An analytical statement is a statement that is inherently true. It is a formal truth that we would call a tautology. 2 + 2 = 4. That statement is analytically true, that is under analysis. You examine what 2 and 2 are, and you see that it is the same thing that you find on the other side of the equation, which is 4. It's a formal truth. It's not something that has to be confirmed by experimentation or observation. It's a mathematical truth, okay? Now, another example of an analytical statement is a bachelor is an unmarried man. Now, you've learned nothing in the predicate that wasn't already in the subject. You've said nothing new that defines the term bachelor than the word itself contains inherently. Do you see what I'm saying? Now, both Protestants and Catholics agree that in the final analysis, no one is justified until or unless God declares that person just. And that declaration of God is a legal declaration by his own judgment. When we say that the Roman view is analytical, that means this, that God will not say that a person is just, will not declare a person legally just unless or until that person under analysis is actually just. He doesn't just count people just who aren't really just. That's why Rome goes on to say in the 16th century that before God will ever declare anybody justified, justice or righteousness must inhere within the soul of the person. The Latin there is inherens. It must be inherent within the person so that nobody really becomes justified until, under analysis, God reads their lives, reads their souls, and sees nothing but righteousness there. If a person dies in mortal sin, he goes to hell. If a person dies with any sin, with any imperfection or blemish on his soul, that person cannot be admitted into heaven, but must first go through the purging fires of purgatory, where those impurities are cleansed away until such time as righteousness is truly inherent in the believer. You see what's at stake here. If I thought that what I had to do to get into heaven was to arrive at a state, no matter how much grace the church has for me, of pure righteousness without any imperfections, I would completely despair of ever having salvation. If you taught me that that's how I am saved, for me, that would not be good news. It would be horrible news. And do you see why what we're see in this discussion and this debate, one of the most significant theological issues you can ever discuss is on the table. What must I do to be saved? As we will see, God willing, in our next session, what the Reformation was about was affirming the biblical gospel that the moment a person possesses saving faith, they are transformed from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light, are declared to be just on the basis of the righteousness of Christ, and are adopted into the family of God, have their sins in remission and taken away forever. No purgatory, no second plank of justification. But, as I said, God willing, we'll look at that view in our next time together.
Well, as we heard Dr. Sproul say there, these two views of justification are profoundly different and incompatible with one another. We thank you for listening to Renewing Your Mind today as we continue Dr. Sproul's series, Luther and the Reformation. The 500th anniversary of Luther's stand against the Catholic Church is less than a week away. We spent the month highlighting the biblical foundation of the Reformation. At the beginning of the program today, R.C. asked if most Protestants even understand why the Reformation took place. We realize that many people don't know much about it. That's why we're concentrating on this topic. We believe it's important, and we want to help you and your family learn as much as possible about these doctrines. To that end, we're offering you the Reformation USB Resource Drive for your gift of any amount today. We have compiled 8 video teaching series, including the current series, along with 6 ebooks and several digital copies of Table Talk magazine, and we've placed them on this one USB drive. You can give your gift securely online when you visit renewingyourmind.org, or you can call and make your request at 800-435-4343. When you receive the drive, you'll find Dr. Sproul's teaching series, Justified by Faith Alone, along with a series on Roman Catholicism. But also on that drive are several e-books, including Sola Scriptura and Are We Together? So again, contact us with your gift of any amount when you call us at 800-435-4343 or when you go to renewingyourmind.org. Before we go, let me thank you for listening to Renewing Your Mind. We often hear from listeners who connect with us on their local radio station or via podcast or on the free Ligonier app. There are many ways to listen. To find out more about that, just go to renewingyourmind.org. Well, tomorrow, Dr. Sproul looks at the view of justification that was rediscovered in Luther's day. Is it true that God placed our sins on His own Son and at the same time declares the guilty righteous because of Christ's merit? We'll explore that very important question tomorrow on Renewing Your Mind.